If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast guest is Francesca Wade. Francesca's new book, Square Haunting, explores the lives of five pioneering women that are linked by a square in Bloomsbury. From modernist poet H.D. to writer and publisher Virginia Woolf, all of these women worked and wrote in London between the two world wars, seeking space, independence and recognition. Eleanor Evans met Francesca at Faber's offices in Bloomsbury to find out more.
So your book, Square Haunting, considers the lives of five pioneering women connected by a certain area of London. And I wondered if we could just start by perhaps talking about the square that is central to your book.
Yeah. Well, the book is about five women who all lived at different times during the interwar period in Mecklenburg Square. And Mecklenburg Square is this beautiful sort of Georgian gem on the eastern edge of Bloomsbury, backing onto Gray's Inn Road, where it becomes Clerkenwell. The square was built around 1804 on land which was owned by the Foundling Hospital, which was one of kind of 18th century Bloomsbury's major landlords, along with the Bedford Estate. So the Foundling Hospital was opened by Thomas Coram, who wanted to start a home for children on the model of European foundling hospitals. And he managed to raise the money to acquire this big plot of land in central London, which I think was a former duelling ground. And there was so much demand for the hospital that they pretty soon began to run out of money. And eventually, after a lot of discussion about what it would mean for the air pollution and so on and the effects of the children of living in a built-up environment, they decided to develop the huge estate that they had and build two residential squares, Brunswick and Mecklenburg Squares. So Mecklenburg Square is on the east side, and it took about 15-20 years to build. I think there's a huge amount of correspondence about the quality of building materials and the debates about how they were going to kind of sub-license dodgy contractors to build these mansions, and was anyone going to want to live there? But eventually the square as we know it was was finished with the garden in the middle, which largely remains unchanged. I think it's got some of the oldest trees in London and some of the flower beds are still the same.
So Bloomsbury in the interwar period, I guess some listeners might have preconceptions of what that means, but can you give us a sense of what Bloomsbury was like at this time and what it meant for the people who lived there?
Yeah, well, Bloomsbury has such an interesting kind of cultural history because I think people really associate it with the famous Bloomsbury group and people associate it now with, you know, being very central and very expensive. But in the kind of turn of the 20th century, it was a very different situation because when Bloomsbury was originally laid out by the Duke of Bedford estate, he had this vision that he would be developing a kind of upper middle class suburb where rich families would live. But by the time the area was finished, any family who could afford a house there really wanted to live in West London, in Mayfair or St James, which was much, much more fashionable. So Bloomsbury became sort of derided as this kind of symbol of sort of, I don't know, aspirational middle class living. It was definitely, you know, snobbishly it was seen as a, you know, not at all a cool place to live. And so some of these huge houses started to languish and be empty. And eventually, particularly on the Foundling Estate, the Bedford Estate held out for longer, but the Foundling Estate, which included Mecklenburg and Brunswick Squares, decided that they had to do something about this and they had to divide up these houses into flats or boarding houses. And this development happened at an interesting time for women in particular, where a lot of women, you know, were soon about to get the vote. A lot had universities had opened to women in the second half of the 19th century. And so it was a real time of change and new possibility for women who might not want to just go straight from their family home into a marital home, but might want to have a period of living alone or living with a friend or moving to London to look for work. And so these houses suddenly being available at relatively low rents happened at a time when a lot of kind of interesting, ambitious women were looking to move to Bloomsbury.
And your book centres on five of these women whose lives at some point or other converged in Mecklenburg Square. Can you introduce them for us?
Yeah. The first chapter is about the poet Hilda Doolittle, who was known as HD. She's a really fascinating figure. She was at one point was engaged to Ezra Pound when they were both living in America. I think she was quite relieved when that engagement quite quickly broke down. But she did come to London quite soon after he'd come here and got very involved in the sort of poetic scene around him, and which is where she met her husband, Richard Aldington. And so she lived in Mecklenburg Square during a period of the First World War, which was a particularly turbulent period for her because Aldington, her husband, was conscripted and he was away fighting and then coming home and having an affair with the upstairs lodger. Meanwhile, D.H. Lawrence and his wife, who she knew a bit, had been exiled from their house in Cornwall, and she sort of put them up in the square. And at the same time, she was trying to work out her own position as a sort of wife on the home front and was doing that largely by looking back to Greek tragedy. She was a real Hellenophile. And some of her most interesting poetry, I think, was written during these difficult years. Mm-hmm. Then there's Dorothy L. Sayers, who is best known for her Lord Peter Wimsey detective novels. And she was an interesting one to write about during this time because she's someone who later in life, her books were complete bestsellers. They're still in print. She's really well known as one of the heroines of golden age detective writing, along with people like Agatha Christie. But I'm writing about her during a time when none of this seemed even possible to her. She'd just graduated. She was in the first batch of women to be allowed to graduate from Oxford. And she arrived in the square really just knowing that she wanted to be a writer and was completely determined in that, but wasn't really sure if the success that she wanted was ever going to be hers. And so this is the year when she was writing her first novel, which became Whose Body? Then there's the classicist Jane Harrison, who I'm writing about at a completely different time, right at the end of her life. She was a really amazing figure. She was at Newnham in Cambridge, where her theories about the matriarchal origins of Greek religion were hugely controversial amongst the more conservative of her colleagues in the Cambridge classics faculty. And Cambridge, unlike Oxford, refused to allow women to take degrees. And eventually in 1921, she was so fed up of this that she left with Hope Merlies, her sort of partner, who was a former student, and they went off to Paris. And then they came to Bloomsbury and they threw themselves into projects of Russian translation. She'd started learning Russian during the war and were involved in a whole circle of Russian emigres who'd been exiled after the revolution. Then there's the economic historian Eileen Power, who lived in the square for 20 years while teaching international history at the LSE. And she's a really fascinating figure. She moved from writing her best-selling book, Medieval People, which was one of the first Pelican books. And she moved from that into doing a lot of work for international history. And as it became clear that another war was on the cards, she really saw her job as a historian to make sure that future generations would be taught history in a way that would make sure that they would consider themselves citizens of the world and not be able to kind of lead their countries into further wars. And the last chapter is about Virginia Woolf, who is by far the best known of any of these people. But I'm writing about her at a interesting time of her life. I think it's she moved in just as the Second World War was declared, and she died in 1941, so this is the last year of her life. But of course, she didn't know it was going to be the last year of her life. And I think it's often read as the year leading up to her suicide. But in fact, during this year, she was full of exciting projects. She was working on her novel, Between the Acts. She was writing a biography of her old friend, Roger Fry, and she was beginning to work on a memoir of her childhood as well as still being involved in the Hogarth Press, which operated from their house in the square.
Yes, so they're all clearly incredible women, and perhaps we can go into a little more detail about a few of their stories in a little while. But I wondered if we could just give a bit of extra context of at the beginnings of this period that you're writing about. Women's lives were changing fast at this time, so how did they go about pushing those boundaries?
They all did it in different ways, I guess. I think one of the interesting themes of the book that connects quite a few of them is the changes in women's education. So Dorothy Sayers was one of the first women to graduate from Oxford, and I guess she arrived at university at a time when she and her friends could expect that they would be able to have a pretty different future from their mothers, for example. Whereas Jane Harrison, who is a kind of a generation older than most of the other women that I'm writing about, she was more of a pioneer in that she was one of the earliest students at Newnham at a time when the women students were really not included in the university. And I mean, even by the time that Sayers was at Oxford, there are lots of stories about lecturers refusing to sort of turning their backs on the women students, or really not wanting to see them in their kind of caps and gowns out in the streets of Oxford. And I think Eileen Power and Jane Harrison as female academics had to contend with a lot of suspicion. I mean, Jane Harrison is an interesting story in that respect, because she, after she left university, she spent most of her life trying to be accepted for a prestigious position and being rejected by all male committees, who just couldn't really countenance having someone like her within the establishment. But in a way, she turned that to her advantage. She, I think the classical studies at that time were very focused on the kind of editing of canonical texts, but she wasn't interested in that sort of work. What she wanted to do was these huge broad brush pioneering works, where she would just kind of smash through everything that anyone thought that they knew about ancient religion. And ironically, because a lot of her theories have subsequently been proved to not be particularly accurate. So a lot of her work then gets overwritten and superseded, and she sort of has fallen out of history in some ways. But no one could have done the work that they did after that if it weren't for her coming in with the imagination to put together these theories, which may not be entirely accurate, but still open doors and ways of thinking.
Yeah, talking of those doors opening, while the square is obviously the overriding thing in your book that links these women's lives, they did, you know, you found that they inspired each other and they did have some interactions themselves. What can you say about what you found about that?
Well, that was one of the most interesting things about the research, I think, that, you know, what really brought all these women together was just this coincidence that at some point they had all been living in Mecklenburg Square. But I guess as the more I researched, the more I realised that it wasn't entirely a coincidence, because Bloomsbury was a place where these women were drawn to because of the universities being nearby, publishing houses being nearby, and it being a place where it seemed possible to live a different sort of life.
Something that features prominently in your work inevitably is a room of one's own. Mm. So what kind of freedom did these spaces, and in particular Bloomsbury, offer women at this time?
Yeah, I think when I started thinking about what had brought them all to Bloomsbury and what might connect them, I kept going back to a room of one's own and everything that Wolf says there about how important it is to have a space in both a literal space in a house where no one's going to interrupt you while you work, and also, you know, the metaphorical space of feeling validated in your work, knowing that that you can do what you want to do, and that, you know, being a woman writer is not an oxymoron, and I think all of these women were keen to stretch the boundaries of what they might be expected to do, which of course was also very difficult for them, because they were all caught in this bind between the intellectual fulfillment that they were all guarded very closely and kind of emotional fulfillment. And I think particularly in Dorothy Sayers' story is quite moving in that way, I think, because she is completely determined to be a writer and to finish her book. But during this year, she was also involved in a relationship with a slightly older man who was also a writer, who really didn't think much of her work. It's pretty apparent from her later letters to him, which are really poignant. And I think it was a time for her, which in fact she then is a real theme of a lot of her later books, including her amazing 1936 novel Gaudy Night, in which her character Harriet Vane, who lives in Mecklenburg Square, has to try and work out whether she can accept the marriage proposal of the great detective Lord Peter Wimsey, and whether it's even possible for her to maintain her independence and her freedom whilst also getting married.
And I think this fight for independence is a really interesting one, because I think you write, particularly when writing about HD, Hilda Doolittle, she's been viewed a lot inevitably through the men in her life. Mm. When historians have written about her. Yeah. You mentioned Ezra Pound, you mentioned D.H. Lawrence. How do you approach writing these women, you know, as individuals, focusing on when so many historical sources are inevitably perhaps viewed through the men in their lives?
Mm. Yeah, I think that was definitely particularly the case with HG. She's seen as Pound's fiance, Aldington's wife. She's often seen as Lawrence's muse in a way that really doesn't bear out in much of the historical record. I think there was quite an early biography of Lawrence which read her novel Bid Me to Live so autobiographically that it assumed that she must have been the model for Lady Chatterley, and that possibly Lawrence was the father of her daughter Perdita. And later she had analysis with Freud, and she's often seen in that context as well. But it was interesting writing about this period, because it's, in a way, it's the story of her kind of leaving this quite traditional setup where she found herself put into the position of sort of abandoned wife, which really didn't match with the way that she was conceiving of herself in her as a writer in her own right. And she had, when she and Aldington got married, I think they very much conceptualized their relationship as one of equals, of, you know, two poets working alongside each other. But after she left the square, she moved to Cornwall, and that's where she met Briar, who then became her partner for the rest of her life. And they wrote to each other every day when they went together. And Briar helped bring up Perdita, HG's daughter, and was a really, really crucial person in the rest of HG's life, for whom HD's work was completely paramount. And she, Perdita, wrote quite a moving memoir about Briar sort of insisting that, you know, her mother needed time to write, and that there were times when she just couldn't be interrupted. And I think that was finding a relationship where that was understood was really crucial for HD.
And there was an interesting link between Virginia Woolf and Jane Harrison, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, there were some interesting connections between some of the women themselves. Virginia Woolf met Jane Harrison early on in her career and was quite inspired by her example. And in fact, Jane Harrison appears as a figure in Room of One's Own as an example of the kind of pioneering woman that Virginia Woolf is saying that, you know, we could have more of if we allowed women the time and space to write, which I think was very much evident in Jane Harrison's own story. It wasn't until she was invited back to Newnham, the Women's College in Cambridge, later on in her life, that she began to write the books that really made her name. That when she was living, you know, in kind of rented, sort of going between different lodgings and travelling around the country giving lectures, she just didn't really have the time to sit down and concentrate on a work like her Prolegomena to Greek Religion, which is huge. And I was always looking, when I was researching this book, for connections between the women, both thematically and, you know, any times that they did meet or overlap, and there were some really fascinating overlaps. I found, when I was at Cambridge University Library, I found Eileen Power's address book, and I obviously looked for all of the others, and I found Dorothy Sayers listed and was so intrigued because I couldn't think quite how they would have met. I knew that they were both involved at the BBC, and Dorothy Sayers later on in life had wrote more historical plays in particular, so I sort of wondered. But then at Wheaton College in Illinois, which is where Dorothy Sayers' papers are, along with lots of the other Inklings papers, I found a letter from Eileen Power to Dorothy Sayers. They'd clearly been introduced at a party and started talking about what Sayers was currently working on, which I think was Palestine in the first century AD. And Eileen Power had sent her a copy of a book which she thought would be useful to Sayers. And she added, "It was such a pleasure to meet you," at the end, which I just thought was a really nice example of this kind of recognition between them. They were two, you know, women scholars meeting as professional women and helping each other out in that way. It seemed a nice encapsulation of what the book's about.
And did you find any other odd links while you were travelling in these women's footsteps?
I found quite a few. At some point it felt like my life was sort of becoming the book in a strange way. I went to Cornwall to look at the house where HD had stayed with a man called Cecil Gray after she left Mecklenburg Square. And I was booking a room to stay in nearby and found a nice little farmhouse near the village of Zennor. And as I was reading Virginia Woolf's diaries later that evening, I came across a passage where she said, "I'm in a cottage out on the Cornish moors, and I'm writing this with a pen lent to me by the landlady, Mrs. Berryman." And I just had an email from a Mrs. Berryman confirming my stay, and I wrote back to her and said, "Did you meet Virginia Woolf?" And she said that would have been her husband's grandmother. So it feels like, you know, the ghosts are out there.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast:
both Power and Harrison were so keen to be seen as professional women that, in a way, perhaps burning a lot of their more personal papers was a pretty deliberate act to make sure that they were going to be taken seriously in the future as professionals, as historians.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. you may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I'm interested about the sources, because while you write that Virginia Woolf, probably the most well-known name in your book, her life is there's a lot of sources for it. Some of the other women... there were challenges, you know, difficulties of burned papers or vanished correspondences. How did that affect what you found out about these women?
Well, the difficulty of the book, I suppose, is trying to make the chapters balanced when for Virginia Woolf, you've got all of her letters and diaries are published and, you know, you can put together what she was doing every day pretty much of this year, which is hugely helpful, though, of course, that brings out its own questions about the way she was constructing herself quite carefully, particularly in her diary, which she did anticipate would be read and possibly published. HD was a different sort of problem because she wrote about this period in fiction across her life. She wrote several different novels where she took the events of this year and put them in different contexts and had different kind of emphasis on different events and included some different characters who don't occur in other versions of the narrative. And she did a historical version set in a Roman army camp. She did one in which Aldington really doesn't appear very much at all, and it's about these two relationships with women that she had before and after him. And then there are other versions where it's all about the breakdown of this marriage. And there's one much later book, Bid Me to Live, which she went back to after her analysis with Freud, when he suggested that what really she needed to do in order to get over this writer's block that she'd come to him about was go back to this period in Mecklenburg Square, which he thought held the key to untangling a lot of her sort of psychic drama. But then working with those novels, it's really fascinating to compare them and to try to carve a kind of path between them. But it's difficult because she's not the only one who wrote novels about this time. D.H. Lawrence, John Cornos, who's another friend of hers, who in fact is also the man that Dorothy L. Sayers had this difficult relationship with, which I think is a total coincidence. I can't think of two people much more different than H.D. and Sayers. But there was a huge ream of letters, I think, from Aldington to HD and from her to him, which got left in the basement of 44 Mecklenburg Square when they all dispersed and someone remembers them being burnt. And Eileen Power and Jane Harrison also, there are a lot of their more personal papers were destroyed. Jane Harrison made a huge bonfire after she left Cambridge in 1921. So loads of material which would have been fascinating relating to her has gone, and it's difficult to make up for that. But I suppose both of them, both Power and Harrison, were so keen to be seen as professional women, that in a way, perhaps burning a lot of their more personal papers was a pretty deliberate act to make sure that they were going to be taken seriously in the future as professionals, as historians, rather than have people like me mind their papers for, you know, juicy details about their love lives.
Well, can we talk a little bit more about Power then? Because she is such a fascinating figure in your book.
Well, one of the things I found most interesting about her was looking into the broadcasts that she made for the BBC, often with her younger sister Rhoda. They were invited onto the BBC quite early on in the BBC's programming during the 30s. There was a series of broadcasts for children which were beamed into schools across the country, and Eileen Power, who'd been a lecturer and researcher at LSE for some time, really took up the challenge to deliver her research to children, because I think she thought that it was absolutely crucial that children should be taught a world history, not British history. She was very insistent on that. She was quite involved in campaigning for the League of Nations, and she really believed that the only way to prevent war in the future was to teach history that wasn't about wars and wasn't about countries being better than other countries. It was about emphasizing what we have in common and teaching, you know, the history of the East in tandem with the history of the West. And a lot of her own more academic research focused on trade routes. She was particularly interested in China. And one of her last books, which came out of some lectures she delivered at Oxford in 1940, is about the world trade, which is usually, I think, seen as England's kind of great triumph in the sort of 13th century. But she was keen to emphasise what an international collaboration this all was.
How is her work recognised, or is it today?
Mm. So much of her work during the 30s, I think, was to do with kind of public engagement, and she wrote a lot for more mainstream newspapers and journals, and did lots of lecturing and did these BBC broadcasts and did a lot of teaching, which I guess means that, you know, that work is a bit intangible, because I think she will have influenced and affected a whole generation of people who will have grown up listening to her, but that legacy, you know, can't be quantified in quite the same way. And she died very suddenly in 1940, when she was only in her early 50s. And so she didn't go on to continue publishing. And she was married to a historian called Michael Poston, who had started off as her research assistant. And they collaborated very closely through the 30s, really. And he got a job just quite soon before she died at Cambridge. And I think after the war, the sorts of methodology that they had been developing at the LSE and with their colleagues through the years really came to fruition. And Michael Poston went on and had a very distinguished career. But Eileen Power's name tended to fade away. And so now she worked also very, very closely with R.H. Tawney, who also lived in Mecklenburg Square. They were neighbours and really close friends and colleagues at the LSE, and they ran seminars together a lot. And his reputation obviously has thrived, and he has a blue plaque in the square.
But not one for Eileen Power yet.
No, not yet. But I think she absolutely deserves to be remembered for her historical work.
And Mecklenburg Square, there is something that happens at number 37 each year in Virginia Woolf's study that was likely Virginia Woolf's study.
In 1940, the square was bombed, and so a lot of the houses were subsequently destroyed and rebuilt as Goodenough College, which now takes up most of the square. But the archivist there, when I was doing some research in their archives, told me that they've worked out pretty much exactly where Virginia Woolf's study would have been at number 37. And now each year that room is given to a woman student, and they leave a copy of A Room of One's Own waiting for her, which is a really nice way to continue the square's history as a place of pioneering women.
That was Francesca Wade. Her book, Square Haunting, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars, is published by Faber in the UK and is out now, and Crown Publishing in the US from the 7th of April. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday when Rachel Herman will be discussing food in the American Revolution.